Good afternoon. My name is Rachel Newsom, and I'm the Vice President of Federal and State Health Policy here at the Commonwealth Fund. 2020 will mark 10 years since the passage of the Affordable Care Act and its historic reforms and coverage expansions. However, as Commonwealth Fund surveys show us time and again, many Americans are still facing challenges around affording coverage with little signs that healthcare costs are abating, and far too many Americans remain uninsured or underinsured. 2020 is also an election year, and we have every reason to believe that healthcare will continue to be a driving issue for voters at the polls. For these reasons and others, Medicare for All and other proposals aimed at achieving universal coverage are once again on the table and will likely stay there for the foreseeable future. We're here today to examine the range of proposals that have been put forth. The Commonwealth Fund does not endorse or oppose specific legislation, but we are committed to achieving a health system that provides high-quality, affordable care for all Americans. We have three Commonwealth Fund experts here with us today to help us understand the range of proposals and what's at stake for our nation's healthcare system and the patients it serves. We're pleased to have Sarah Collins, Vice President of the Fund's Healthcare Coverage and Access Program, Robin Osborne, Vice President of the Fund's International Health Policy and Practice Program, and David Blumenthal, President of the Commonwealth Fund, join us for this conversation. So let's start with the first question for you, Sarah. There's a lot of ways that people talk about expanding health insurance and a lot of terms that are used that may help to define, may help for you to help us define here. Medicare for All, Medicare buy-in, a public option. Can you take just a moment and give us an overview of the proposals that are out there right now?
Thank you, Rachel. So the one way of approaching this, and this is how our new interactive tool at the Commonwealth Fund that looks at these plans does this, is to think about the U.S. health insurance system as comprised of both public and private sources of insurance coverage. Private coverage includes employer plans and plans that people buy in the individual market and the Affordable Care Act marketplaces. And public plans include Medicare and Medicaid, the Veterans Administration health insurance. In addition, both types of coverage, private and public, are financed by a mix of private and taxpayer-financed public dollars. For example, we generally think of employer coverage as private, but it's heavily financed by the federal government because employers' premium contributions to their employees' insurance doesn't count as income to the people who have it. In 2018, this subsidy amounted to $280 billion, which is the single largest federal tax expenditure. In contrast, we generally think of Medicare and Medicaid as public insurance, but millions of enrollees in both programs get their federally financed coverage through a private health plan. And because Medicare has a lot of cash sharing and doesn't cover things like dental and vision care, most people buy private supplemental insurance to pay for these uncovered services. The recent set of proposals from House and Senate Democrats seek to address the current problems in the healthcare system that Rachel laid out. Lots of people still uninsured, many people with high out-of-pocket costs and deductibles relative to their income so that they're effectively underinsured, and high healthcare costs. They've looked at addressing these issues by expanding the public dimensions of our healthcare system. These bills can be characterized as falling along a continuum with Medicare for All proposals at one end. As the interactive tool illustrates, the bills that have been introduced recently range from adding somewhat more public sector involvement in the system to adding substantially more public sector involvement. The recent set of bills can be grouped into broadly three categories. In the first group are bills that would add public plan features to private insurance. These bills include provisions that would increase the regulation of private plans, like requiring private insurers who participate in Medicare and Medicaid to also offer plans to the marketplaces. They would also increase premium subsidies for marketplace plans. In the second group are bills that would build in a choice of public plans alongside private plans for people to buy through the marketplaces or even through their employers, or to give people ages 50 to 64 the option to buy into Medicare, or to give states the options to let people buy into Medicaid. But the bills are technically not buy-ins to the current actual programs, but a plan option based on the characteristics of the program, Medicare or Medicaid. And the third set are what we traditionally think of as Medicare for All plans. They make all residents eligible for a single plan that, again, resembles the current Medicare program but isn't the same Medicare program we have today. The proposals would effectively consolidate the financing and administration of most of the healthcare system into a single plan operated by the federal government. They would replace private insurance as well as Medicaid and the current Medicare program.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. That's a great description. And again, folks, if you want to see the details of the different proposals, the interactive is able to show that. Sarah, one of the findings from our survey makes it very clear that affordability of coverage, but also stability of coverage, the sense of whether or not the insurance plans will be there to protect them when Americans get sick, those are really the primary concerns when Americans are asked about their concerns around the health system. How did these proposals address these concerns?
Well, at one end of the spectrum, the Medicare for All bills would significantly reduce premiums or cost sharing or eliminate it for most people. But depending on how the program was financed, those expenses would likely be replaced by higher taxes, at least for some people. And the bills would guarantee that everybody would have health insurance by fiat. By contrast, the bills that add public plan elements to private plans or give people a choice of public plans gain some of the improved affordability that characterizes a single public plan without the disruption that would entail, and also add choice for people to ensure that they have coverage options. For example, the bills that would add public plan elements to private plans include provisions that would lower premium costs in the individual market by enhancing the current ACA's premium tax credits. They'd enhance and extend the marketplace cost-sharing reduction subsidies, place a cap on prescription drug spending, and ensure that people have plans to enroll in the marketplaces regardless of where they live by requiring that insurers that offer plans in Medicare and Medicaid offer them in the marketplaces. And reinsurance is also a reoccurring policy proposal. Bills that would add a choice of public plans for people, Medicare buy-ins, for example, would lower consumer costs by allowing HHS to set the premiums for these plans. The provisions would also enhance the ACA's premium and cost-sharing subsidies, which would be applicable to the public plans. They would giving the employers the option to offer a public plan choice might lower both employer and employee premium costs. But adding a public plan option also increases the certainty that people will actually have a plan to enroll in.
Great, thank you. And one more question on costs. We know that consumers and patients aren't the only ones worried about healthcare costs. And one of the critiques of the ACA, in fact, is that it didn't go far enough to address costs. How did these proposals impact overall healthcare costs?
Yeah, and it's really important for people to remember that what's driving consumers' higher healthcare spending on premiums and deductibles is the overall rate of growth in healthcare costs. So a goal of these bills is to attempt to lower cost growth by bringing state and federal government leverage to slow the rate, either through increased regulation of private markets, introducing these public plan choices into private markets, or consolidating the financing administration of the healthcare system into a single plan. For example, provisions in the bills that add public plan elements to the private plans that might lower costs are tightening the premium rate review leverage of federal and state regulators over private plans by allowing them to reject unreasonably high premiums proposed by insurers. And these bills could also add regulated provider fee schedules for private plans offered in the marketplace or even extended to employer plans. Among the bills that would add a choice of public plans, HHS, or Health and Human Services, would negotiate or set provider premium rates at the Medicare rate or somewhere between Medicare and commercial provider rates. They would require, nearly all of them would require the secretary to negotiate prescription drug prices for both the public plan option and the current Medicare drug program. This could reduce federal costs because it would lower premium tax credits, the cost of premium tax credits. And the Medicare for All bills would require HHS to negotiate prescription drugs and provider rates. And two bills in that group of Medicare for All bills would take that leverage a step further by establishing global and capital budgets for hospitals, nursing homes, and other institutional providers. But generally, this Medicare for All approach, by reducing the role of profits in the healthcare system, reducing administrative complexity, and providing the government with leverage over provider prices, would likely lead to significant reductions in overall spending like it has in other countries.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. Robin, that's a great segue. As we know from the work your program's been producing, nearly all other industrialized nations have universal coverage, but they get there in very different ways, though the vast majority are leveraging both the private and public sector, similar to here in the U.S. What lessons from abroad are applicable for the U.S.?
So when we look across industrialized countries, the hallmark of the healthcare systems is universal coverage. But I think one of the interesting points that really bears some attention is the many different models that they use for providing universal coverage, the different paths to getting there. At one end of the spectrum, you could have the fully tax-funded NHS in England. At the other end of the spectrum, for example, you would have the Dutch and the Swiss models, which are based on private insurance, competition, individual mandate, and the delivery system dominated by private providers. So while all of these models for universal coverage represent different ways of getting there, the one thing that they do have in common is a broad consensus in these countries that everyone is entitled to access to health care. And there's a social contract, in effect. And there also is an understanding and a role for government that's accepted in terms of ensuring that health care is affordable. So when we look across the countries, we see that they provide universal coverage. They are far more protective than the U.S. in terms of the insurance coverage that people get. And this includes even for Medicare. So when we look at Medicare, which is similar to some of these other programs, we see that, and a very popular program here in the U.S., we see that one in four elderly Americans have cost barriers and are not getting the care they need because of costs. And compared to the other countries, that is really significantly different. We also see that other countries spend a lot less overall than we do on health care, despite the fact that they're covering all of their citizens. They get better outcomes in many cases than the United States. And so they're getting more value for the money that they're spending. And lastly, they have higher satisfaction ratings from the public for the healthcare system and the care that they receive.
Great. Thanks, Robin. David, one of the big questions for many folks when considering how to cover more Americans is the price tag and how we go about paying for it. When we look at these proposals, what do we know about how much they might cost and how they might be financed?
Well, it's absolutely true that the way in which programs are financed has an enormous political importance. Americans don't like taxes, and even if the amount of money they're spending out of pocket for healthcare is less in a more tax apparent system, there tends to be discomfort with that way of financing. There's a strong case to be made that publicly financed programs can be less expensive, as the international experience shows and as Medicare's low administrative costs show. And as a matter of fact, the cost of Medicare historically has gone up much less rapidly than the cost of private insurance in the United States. Nevertheless, the fact that such a program is financed through taxes tends to make it politically much more difficult to pass and to enact. So the method of financing rather than the amount of cost is often decisive in American political dialogue. That is a factor that has been true throughout the history of debates about universal coverage.
And David or Sarah, there's the question of how we finance it, but then there's also the question of total cost, as David just alluded to. Do we have a sense that these proposals are, in fact, likely to be more expensive, or is it a matter of some would be paying more, some would be paying less? What do we know about that?
Well, this is David, and the international experience suggests that the kinds of controls that are possible to put in place when there is more centralized control over the flow of funds through a healthcare system, those kinds of controls make it possible to impose payment restraints, alternative ways of paying for care that restrain costs. Things like nationally negotiated drug prices, nationally negotiated prices for physician and hospital services and nursing home services, controls on capital expenditure, and also, very importantly, reduced administrative costs associated with the reduction in the numbers of different types of plans, the complexity of billing, the need for providers to maintain multiple billing personnel in order to accommodate the varied provisions and aspects of different private insurance plans. So the international experience and the Medicare experience here would strongly suggest that it is possible to provide universal coverage at lesser cost than the current current private system we have.
Great. Sarah, is there anything that you wanted to add on that last question?
Yeah, and so I think what we're seeing across the range of proposals that we include in the tool is that it is possible to add some of the elements of these Medicare or single payer or one single public plan, Medicare for all type plans, systems into a system that looks somewhat more similar to what we have in the United States, but adding some of these public plan elements or adding a choice of public plans in the marketplaces. For example, adding a Medicare-like option into the marketplaces, whether all of them or some that lack competition, could have the effect by giving the HHS the ability to set premiums and to make some determination over provider rates, would give some of that leverage into our current private system without having to undergo the disruption that a whole single-payer approach might entail.
Great. Go ahead, Robin.
So across all of the systems, one thing is also noteworthy, that all of them have some element of private insurance, even where the system is publicly financed through taxation. And private insurance has different roles. In the NHS, for example, in the UK, where you have this predominantly private national health service, there has always, since the 1940s, been a parallel private insurance dimension to the system that's been about 11% of the population have used it, and it buys quicker access, more choice, better amenities in terms of private hospitals. But you also have, in countries such as Australia, you have encouragement by the government to also, in addition to having a publicly tax-financed system that is available to everyone, the government also encourages people to take out private insurance, and about 50% of the population have private insurance that they can use for elective surgery or to get a choice of specialists that they might not have in the healthcare system. And then, of course, as I mentioned before, in the Netherlands and Switzerland, the insurers are all private, not-for-profit, and they operate in competitive marketplaces, but the government sets the rules on those.
Great.
And similarly, I was just going to say, also in Germany, where you have employer-employee contributions, under the statutory health insurance that are mandatory. The government sets the rate at 14.5% of income split between employer, employee, and then you have 110 not-for-profit competitive sickness funds.
Great, thank you. So a range of different approaches. Well, thanks to all three of our speakers from the fund. We're now going to open it up for your questions for folks on the phone.
At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press star and one on your touch-tone phone. You can remove yourself from the question queue by pressing the pound key. Again, that's star and one. We'll pause a moment to allow any questions to queue. Our first question will come from Amy Watson with Inside Health Policy. Please go ahead.
Hi. Hi, this is Amy Watson. Watson is good, too. I'm curious, how do the other countries deal with abortion coverage?
Robin?
As far as I know, abortion is available and covered in all of the countries. And I don't know what, in the countries that we typically look at, the OECD countries, I don't know with what particular limitations they place on that.
Amy, we can definitely get more information for you on that, at least in terms of what we have access to here at the fund. So we're happy to follow up.
Thanks so much, because we know like how big of an issue it is in this country. So really, really curious how the other countries dealt with it. Thank you.
And again, that is star and one to ask a question. We'll pause a moment to allow any further questions to queue. And it appears we have no further questions at this time. I apologize. We do have a follow-up from Amy. Please go ahead.
Hi. I just figured since I have everyone, I'd ask another question. I'm curious, what would you think would be the biggest hurdle getting to any of these? Do you think it will be hospital objections or issuer objections or the employers wanting to move, or what do you think?
David, why don't we start with you?
The history of efforts to expand coverage shows that there is often a broad coalition of opponents, includes the industry, that are fearful of lesser reimbursement for their services because of the greater controls that public payers exert over expenditures. It includes insurance companies if the proposal reduces their book of business, and it includes, of course, conservatives who are ideologically opposed to expanded government. So I would say that there is a long history of that group of stakeholders being opposed to certain kinds of coverage expansions. And the history also shows that that Americans are easy to make nervous. It's easy to make Americans nervous about new proposals because until recently they have generally been happy with their health care, especially their individual providers, not always with their insurance, but with their individual providers. So the charge, true or not, that some other force, whether it's government or private insurance or some unspecified force, is going to get between them and their doctor as a result of a change in policy, that allegation, that charge, can be very unsettling in the political discussions around expanding coverage.
Great, thanks. Sarah, did you want to address that question? If there were, what you saw as the biggest barriers to maybe moving in this direction with these types of proposals?
I guess first I'd just highlight the Affordable Care Act and the broad-based industry support that that had when it passed into law, both in industry, both on the insurer side and on the rest of the industry. I think that on if you think about the groups of proposals that we've organized the bills currently under discussion in Congress, the ones that build on the current structure of the Affordable Care Act or build on current law, you know, adding, I think there's support among insurers to improve the subsidies in the ACA marketplaces, addressing that over 400% of poverty threshold that so many people are struggling with. And I think adding reinsurance to the marketplaces and making some additional requirements on private plans. I think that those kinds of ideas have been circulating for a while. We're seeing them sprinkled across all these bills. So some of these avenues for getting to universal coverage would probably have somewhat more support than others. I think the cost issue is probably one of the more contentious issues. Obviously, you can add subsidies to the marketplace plans, but you're still not dealing with the underlying rate of growth in healthcare costs. And that if you were going to think about, for example, extending Medicare rates or some of the provider setting or negotiating prescription drug prices, that is going to invite, and we're seeing that on the discussions right now about prescription drugs, that would invite some additional challenges in terms of industry and opposition. But I think there are pieces of these ideas, pieces of these proposals that are in all of them that might gain more support than others.
Great, thanks. Robin, are there, when we look at other industrialized countries that have achieved universal coverage, are there lessons in terms of how they built the coalitions or were able to get the support to, you know, move their programs towards where they are today?
Well, I think that each one is a product of the historical context, the economic context, and the cultural context. So as I've said, these systems are quite different, but I think they do start off with a sense and a kind of social contract that everyone is entitled to affordable health care. And in getting there, I think they're not contentious in that sense. And in getting there, I think what they do, for example, if you look at Germany, which is one of the oldest systems, over 100 years old, it's operated through a number of governance structures that bring everyone to the table. Mm-hmm. So providers are at the table, insurers at the table, consumers are at the table. And there's a lot more transparency in terms of coverage. And I think that there also is an understanding too that healthcare in most of these countries operates with some kind of budget. So there's a kind of negotiation that happens across parties to provide the best care possible, the greatest value mm-hmm. within the costs that are manageable.
Right. Great.
And we do have another question from Meryl Guzner with Modern Healthcare. Please go ahead.
Hi, thanks. Listen, great work that you guys are doing, and I really appreciate this new tool. I haven't looked at it yet. But I want to just touch on this whole question of this idea that there is a possibility of having regulated insurance companies. Is there, all of the German model, which you've been talking about, is there any bills out there yet? There was, you know, the New York Times ran an op-ed on this. There was a whole page of letters run the other day. a lot of the people writing letters were raising questions about it. What has always surprised me is I've never seen anybody actually propose something like that, but which would have the, it seems to me, greater potential to attract political support in this country because it doesn't do away with the insurance industry. Whereas Medicare for All, as we've seen just in the last couple of weeks, has provoked virtually the entire coalition that supported the Affordable Care Act to come out opposed to Medicare for All. So it seems to me, ultimately, it's a political non-starter. Is there any legislation out there that is trying to look at some of these other models or any serious political support for that?
Sarah, do you want to start?
Sure. I mean, I think that's a great question, and David and Rachel have, well, I mean, David and Robin will have insights on that. You know, I think that the structure of the marketplaces is probably sort of a nascent creation that you know that probably closest resembles that kind of a system where we do have a regulated, we impose regulations on health plans that are offering plans through the marketplaces and the individual insurance market with a you know a structured risk adjustment system that operates similarly to some of these to some of the other countries, Netherlands and Germany. So I think that you can see kind of the threads of that kind of system in the ACA marketplaces with subsidies for people and whatnot. But there aren't proposals right now that would sort of build that out in a national way.
So I agree with Sarah that the individual insurance markets as managed by the marketplaces and especially the state run marketplaces, California being and Massachusetts being two of the best examples, do provide models of what a regulated private insurance market might look like. But I would also point to Medicare Advantage, which is a highly regulated private insurance market, and Medicaid Managed Care, which is in some states highly regulated under the contracts that exist. So they're not new proposals, but they're existing precedents that show that that private insurers are willing to accommodate public regulation where the incentives for doing so are strong enough.
Anything you want to add, Robin?
I think looking at some of the models, particularly like the Netherlands, for example, where you have a managed competition model, and you do have government role in setting the benefit basket, you have community rated premiums, you have all of the contributions are then pooled nationally that employers, employees make, are pooled nationally, risk adjusted, and then provided back to the insurers. So insurers feel like it's a level playing field. It takes away some of the concern about the more high risk patients for them. You have a very standardized benefit basket, but there still is competition, and there's competition on a supplementary insurance product. So for services for vision, for dental, for things that are not included in the basic benefit package, people buy their supplemental coverage, and you know, over 80% of the people have supplemental coverage, and they buy it from the same insurance company that they get their basic statutory health insurance from. So the insurers have a role that is, it's regulated, yet they still are able to be competitive, and the reality is there's very little switching of insurance. People can switch insurance every year, and it's under 5%, the amount of people that change insurance.
And just one last detail, Meryl, the proposals that would lift the 400% of income cap on the availability of subsidies would expand the numbers of Americans enrolled in regulated private insurance plans, because those subsidies would be available to individuals buying qualified health plans in either state-based or federally facilitated marketplaces.
Just one last comment I would make is I think that
can I just follow up on that for briefly?
Sure, go ahead.
There are proposals out there to expand the cap, so there may be some limited proposals, but nobody's really proposing this as legislatively as a system. In other words, to say this is a different way to get to universal coverage and put everybody in the same system. And so, you know, it gets to the whole question of Medicaid as well. I mean, it's interesting that the Medicaid under Medicare for All would be eliminated. And no one ever sort of deals with that fact. Is there anybody talking about the idea that maybe just simply integrating all the federal programs and the exchange programs in a single plan? I mean, there's lots of interim steps that would not abolish private insurance and create the kind of political disruption and tax disruption that I think, like I said, the phrase I used earlier, which just sinks all of these proposals and turns too many constituencies into enemies that potentially could be friends of a more comprehensive universal program. I'm really looking to see, there's no bill number on anything or whatever. That's what I'm sort of looking for. Is there anybody seriously talking about that?
No, this is Sarah. What you're describing, that it hasn't been introduced. It's the kind of single financed or federally financed types of systems, or mostly tax financed, but done in a different way with competing private plans, hasn't been introduced. But you see kind of avenues towards that, and one of them is potentially just adding this public option into the marketplaces, and then the bills that would take that and extend it to employers, so that you can envision a public plan, Medicare Part E, I think is one of the ways it's been referred to in one of the bills. Where you have increasing numbers of people in that plan who are getting it through different places, either through the marketplaces or through their own employers, so you're getting to a much bigger risk pool, which is how these other countries are can be distinguished from sort of the more fragmented insurance pools we have in the United States.
Meryl, this is also a good time to remind folks that we are going to be adding to the interactive as additional proposals are released in the coming months. And so as things are released in Congress, we'll be adding to our tool. So we'll keep an eye out for any proposals that might make sense to include.
Just one more follow-up on that. Does anybody, when they talk about Medicare Part E, does anybody talk about it in terms of eliminating Medicaid and just simply having your premium, if you're very poor or qualify for Medicaid, basically be zero, you know, or your tax contribution would be zero if you have no income or very low income? I mean, is elimination of Medicaid, which would then have impact on rate structure, obviously, to providers, because Medicaid pays the less compared to Medicare, compared to private insurance. So is that getting any serious traction or even attention by anybody in the political firmament?
You know, the only place that you see an elimination of Medicaid is in these Medicare for All type proposals, which consolidates all the Medicaid funding and the Medicare funding into one new Medicare program or new single plan. But in the other proposals, Medicaid is maintained. There's obviously the Medicaid buy-ins, which is another type of public plan, extending a public plan option. But you don't see the elimination of the Medicaid program or expansion in these other bills.
Meryl, one issue that has to be dealt with when you eliminate Medicaid and substitute private or privately managed alternatives is that the benefit package in Medicaid is far more generous and more appropriate for low-income individuals than the private health insurance benefit is for most working Americans. So it's not a simple swap. and that needs to be taken into account. Now, the fact is that Medicare for All proposals, some of them include long-term care, which would be a big change and a very expensive addition. Most international programs, I think with the exception of the Netherlands and maybe France, don't...
It's separately funded.
Yeah, funded separately. So it's an additional question that would have to be addressed.
Very good. Listen, thanks a lot. Appreciate the conversation.
And as a reminder, that is star and one to ask a question. And we'll pause a moment to allow any further questions to queue. There are no further questions at this time.
Great. Thank you all for joining us. Have a great afternoon.